Hey, this is Rance, a reader and author and one half of the Quarantine Book Club podcast. Welcome to QBC Conversations, where I take some deep dives into books and stories by independent authors and maybe help you find a new favorite read. Make sure to check out the Quarantine Book Club wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and consider supporting featured authors by buying their books, writing reviews, and spreading the word. Thanks for listening. Hey everybody, this is Rance. I am one half of the Quarantine Book Club, and I am hanging out on a Saturday today with my friend and another author that I absolutely have been super excited to talk to. His name is Alistair Karadec. Alistair, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks.
I am so damn excited to talk to you, and it has been a bit since we planned to have you on the show. I say we as though Bob's here and he's not. first and foremost, thank you for being so flexible when it comes to time. The past few weeks have been a little hellacious here.
That's no problem at all. I know how it goes. You know.
Well, you were the first one too, and you're like, Rance, it looks like life is going a bit wild. Would you like to postpone?
Do you want to risk it?
I was like, yes, thank you so much.
It was like, I would want someone to do that for me, so I would. it's fine, you know. It's stuff happens. Plus, you know, also it makes it less stressful because I have some pretty severe social anxiety. It makes it less stressful when there's like stuff goes wrong on both sides. You know,
it's kind of like. I entirely agree with you there. I actually really love it. I do. I can't tell you how happy I am to hear that. Actually, not the social anxiety part, but rather the fact that that helps you, because I find so often that it also helps me. I need to have that levity of, oh, okay, somebody else is having a hard time in life, or oh, right now scheduling is hell for everybody.
Yeah, so, exactly. Whew. Doesn't need to be. You don't have to be perfect if you know that, if you can see that other people are also sometimes, you know, having to reschedule or having like unforeseen issues.
Problems that are coming up, as I always seem to have.
Stuff happens.
Well, I have, I'm super excited because originally we were going to record this episode. I believe it was about a week after the release of your novel, The Old Love and the New, which came out when it was the beginning of November, I believe November 6th. Am I wrong with that?
November 16th.
I had to put the one in front of it. Okay.
Yeah, 16th.
So how are you feeling since the release of your book? I always love to ask because I think releasing a book is exhausting. How are you doing?
I took a couple of weeks off of my day job around the release, thinking, okay, well, then I'm just going to focus on it and I'm just going to work on marketing, or, you know, maybe start outlining the next one, or, you know, I had plans for what I was going to do afterwards. And I haven't done that.
No plans came to fruition.
I just like, I was unable to, for a while, like, I was not able to do anything productive. I was just watching TV, watching YouTube, just like occasionally posting something on Twitter just to make sure people know I'm here.
That you're still alive?
Yeah, exactly. But it was like, I think it's like the once, you know, you've got the rush of adrenaline and then that falls down and you just get super tired.
100%. I think there is such an extension of the self to write, create, and publish something that is so close to you. And I think anything we create is close to you, right? Yeah. That there is this drop off afterwards of, I've spent all this time, all this effort, all this work doing the thing. Now the thing is out there. I can't tweak the thing. I can't fuck with the thing. And there now I'm tired.
It's done. And I can't tweak it. was a big reason why it took me so long to get it out. Because, what do you mean? Like, if I read it, and I still do it, like if I pick it up and I open it and I'm like, okay, well, maybe this comma should go there instead.
The inevitable post-release, oh, should I fix that? And you have to like keep yourself from doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Like you can't like change it because, well, first of all, you know, Ingram will take 20 more bucks if we had to update the they do that. They take 20 more bucks if you want to change something. So you better make damn sure that it's
that you're making significant changes if you're doing it.
Exactly. Like if you're going to make a change, it can't be a tweak because then, you know, you're going to do it over and over. It has to be because there's a big reason or something. Yes. So yeah, it's like, it's kind of like the letting go of it is kind of a bit of a tricky part, but you know, now it's done and I'm actually quite like it. I actually quite like how it turned out.
That's so gratifying to hear because A, you deserve to be super proud of what you've created. B, you deserve to be immensely proud of this book. I can't wait to shower you with praise over the course of this podcast. But for some very specific reasons, you and I had the chance, I would say we've interacted over Twitter for like what, the past 6 months or so.
Something like that. Yeah. Like, I think you were one of the first people that I communicated with in the Twitter writing community, which I hadn't been. Like, I'd been on Twitter for years, but I was, for some reason, I had never participated in the writing community that much.
That was the same way I was too.
Other communities, like in the trans community. And then I left Twitter for a bit because that, you know, that
because Twitter is a terrifying hell site filled with exactly. People that are just absolute garbage.
And then eventually I was like, okay, well, what if I go back? But then I tried to talk to writers instead of, you know, trolls.
Yeah.
That might be better. And then, you know, it is.
That is at least the hope that's the experience that people have, right? Is that that social media gets to be a positive and connective experience as opposed to a constantly combative, frustrating, or exhausting experience, which I'm sure it has been all of those things for you just in some capacity because Twitter is filled with terrible people.
It is, but then also it's kind of like it's partly my fault if I go looking for them. And sometimes, you know, you can't stop yourself. You kind of go looking for them, like you vaguely hear something's happening, and you know you shouldn't like go and type it in, but you still do.
Let me say that. Well, do you think that sometimes that's more for your own gratification and validation of like, this is a thing that I'm feeling, and I could because let's face it, we know that people don't change their minds often because people are shitty. But like that, if you have to respond to somebody and you're like, look, I know what I'm going to say is not, I can't put this a kind way. There's no kind way for me to put the thing I'm going to say, that oftentimes you say that for your own validation and justification of the way that you feel as opposed to anything else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure. Like, you know, sometimes there's people, sometimes you're like, okay, maybe this person is, I can change their mind, or like they need to learn more about this, and then they'll see, because this other opinion they have seems very reasonable, you know? So maybe, you know, but a lot of the time, you know, you can't change the person's mind. And I don't know if it's venting.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's because you can't really, if you start arguing about these things with people like in real life, or in your family, there's repercussions that, you know, it's kind of cowardly, but on Twitter, you don't have those repercussions. Then you can vent at someone who's a troll on the internet. And you know what? If you don't like them, you can mute them.
Yeah. Mute them, block them, get the hell out of here.
Exactly. But like replying sometimes is a bit like a way to vent sometimes.
Yeah. I have to catch myself doing it now and then. I am more often than I would like to be a combative person. I'm terrified that people are going to look at me and go, that Rance, all he does is start fights on the internet. But sometimes
I have that same worry sometimes, like, or my timeline is going to look like like I'm picking fight with.
Oh, well, you know what? If you ever pick a fight, I'm there. I got your back.
Same.
I'm happy. I'm happy to get your back because I'll see it now and then and be like, Alistair's going after somebody. I'm all here for this. Let's do this.
I'm always like, I try to refrain from it. Usually it doesn't do anything good. It gets nothing good comes out of it, you know? And then I'll be sulking and then my husband will be like, have you been arguing with people on the internet?
Yes, I have. No. I know I shouldn't, but God damn it, I can't help it.
Exactly.
Well, I am super glad that you've decided to hang out with me today. I've had the pleasure of following your book release from the time that you announced it until inevitably your release. And so Sid's story, which is what's told in The Old Love and the New, is something that even before I read your book that I was deeply interested in because I had seen so much of your promotion online about how your book, I mean, it is a dystopia. It deals immensely close with mental health, being medicated for mental health and sort of how that works into a dystopian society as well. The book is absolutely full of queer characters, which is phenomenal because I think we're at this point now, we're starting to see that, like, that to me is the most utopian thing I can imagine. And I love being able to see queerness as represented in dystopian books. Mm. How do you feel about writing a dystopia? Do you sometimes look at the world around you and go, oh my God, I'm actually writing into something that's way more accurate to reality than not?
And I thought, yeah. Yeah. And especially because I didn't set out to write a dystopia. Like I don't read that much dystopia. I have now because of research, you know, I needed to, but I hadn't read that much dystopia before I started writing it. And I think that's because I'm more interested in the little story than the big one. So when I started developing it, I had a lot of trouble getting my ducks in a row when it comes to like political climate and stuff like that. So there was a lot of research, and I tried as much as I could to base it on stuff that actually happened, so that, you know, it's dystopian because it hasn't happened, but then, you know, it's fiction because it hasn't happened. It's not necessarily futuristic or other, you know, it's not something that couldn't happen. So I didn't want it to feel like something that couldn't happen. So I tried to, look into stuff that had already happened. And I looked into, the Berlin Wall. Mm-hmm. I looked into the Hong Kong protests, which when I started writing hadn't happened yet. And then the pandemic hit when I was like getting ready to doing the fine tuning. And then I was like, well, now it's going to look like I'm jumping on some kind of sick bandwagon because there's this big illness going on. And this book has a big illness that went mm-hmm. on in the yeah. past. So I didn't want it to feel like I was jumping on the trend.
I don't
in light of this.
Actually, one of the things that I love about your book, first and foremost, is how it deals with physical illness, quarantine, things of this. These are natural parts of this world. And no, at no point does it feel like jumping on a trend. In fact, I think literature at the right times serves as a reflection of our world that we're in. You know, it's a book like yours. There is greater insight to be had into it, knowing, I think, especially we go like 10, 15 years in the future. And by this point, you'll have released plenty of other books, but people will still obviously have access to and want to read this one. And to some readers at some point, like both the history of our most recent pandemic experience will sort of meld with this and the fact that it was a product. Would you say this is a product of being in quarantine, or had you written this, had you written the majority of this before the
pandemic? I wrote all of this before the pandemic.
Okay. Like,
I started writing it. It was my master's thesis. So I was writing it in 2013. Was when I graduated with my master's degree, and that was the first 25,000 words of it or so was my master's thesis.
Okay.
So it was already the quarantine part was already very much set before COVID happened. So once it happened, I was able to like go back and maybe tweak stuff.
Sure.
Or see what was, you know, or sometimes think, you know, I was writing this thinking, this isn't believable. That it wouldn't be that messy, right? Or it wouldn't be that disorganized, right?
But reality is. You're not stupid.
Well, as it turns out, you can make a government as stupid as you want, and it's still going to somehow be realistic, which is sad. But,
I think people oftentimes cling, for some asinine reason, they cling as readers to this idea that things have to be realistic in a book. We're looking for the book to be an accurate representation of our world. And so therefore, if it's not fully accurate, we rebel against it. We're like, oh no, that wasn't a realistic book. And then of course they turn around and read books that have magic and wonderful science in them. So I always get frustrated a little bit when people look at a piece of fiction and they get reactive to its realism / lack of realism. Yeah. Because
like this wouldn't happen like that. I know it. In this case, you know, you might, in some cases, you might prefer to have something unrealistic for the sake of like emotional resonance rather than have a specific detail. Right. But then it just falls flat because it's just at some point, just read a history book. If you want the exact date of this or the exact,
if you want that kind of that specificity and that just the sheer recollection and reading for the act of recollection alone of what the past was. Yeah. Pick up a damn history book.
And I mean, that's fine too. Like that's sure. Perfectly. That's perfectly fine if that's what you want. You know, it's not like less good or anything. It's just different.
Yeah. I loved the fact that your dystopia broke away from our expectations as modern readers of what the dystopia should be. We look at things like The Hunger Games, and this is what's in our brain as a dystopia.
Right.
Maybe, you know, The Hunger Games, Battle Royale, even more recently something like Squid Game, which I haven't seen. Right. So I'm only basing that on my
seen it either, but from what I've heard, yeah, it's more futuristic. Like it's got this subgenre of the sci-fi in it, you know.
And your book is a little more grounded in reality. It has a little bit more levity than something that is seated itself heavily in the futuristic, which I think to some people, and if it is, to hell with them, to some people would be almost off-putting. But the truth is dystopias are not required to be futuristic in appearance or in nature. They simply have to be, they are oppressive societies where we have one character who sees through the cracks in that oppression.
Yes. Yeah. And I think I've had some trouble like knowing how to market this because technically it's dystopian. I can't say it's not, you know, it is. It's just alternate history.
Yes.
It is dystopian, but is it going to appeal to a fan of like a dystopia reader? I don't know, to be honest, because I don't delve into what's into the big the world, the world history exactly, and I've tried to avoid info dumping. I've tried to avoid giving information that's not relevant to the small story.
Yeah.
Which sometimes, you know, might get a bit confusing. I don't know. And honestly, I don't think there's a perfect, I haven't perfected a way to do that. So
well,
I don't know.
I would say wholeheartedly, not confusing at all. That is also the nature of having a first person perspective narrator too, is that we have to rely on that narrator being our only conduit to that world.
Yeah, you can't know stuff that they don't know.
So. Exactly. And there's going to be things that are just so normal for them, they don't have to share it with us.
Yeah, exactly. You can't describe something that's... Otherwise, you just end up with, like, as you well know, this happened.
Well, just for anybody who might not know, there's a law in this world that... it's like, oh, shit, this guy's just telling me everything because I am clearly an outsider here.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about, if you were going to describe your book to anybody who's listening and they have not had the chance to pick it up yet, and if you haven't, please pick up The Old Love and the New by Alistair Karadec, because it is an absolutely ass-kicking book. What would you say to people if you're trying... I hate it, Alistair, when people come up to me and they find out I'm an author and they're like, oh, what's your book about?
What is it about?
So I'm going to ask you, what's your book about? How would you elevator pitch this to people? If you'd like them to pick it up or give us like a synopsis or a summary or an idea of what it is.
Well, I've thought about this a lot. And I came up with a lot of bad ways to describe it. And usually I think what I would say is that, you know, that typical, you know, dystopia hero who's a bit of a rebel and he's going to go up against this oppressive government, and he's probably going to like protect some woman that he's found, you know, and he's probably going to fall in love with her, you know. That story is about this guy's best friend, and he's got schizoaffective disorder, mm-hmm. and anxiety, and he's very self-deprecating, and he's kind of in love with the guy who's going to fall in love with the girl. So I think that's how I would describe it. It's queer and it's drama more than it is dystopian.
I love this determination of the separation between what you had said earlier. I've never thought about this before, the small story and the large story. And I'm going to not stop thinking about that. So Sid's story is the small story. It's the intimate story that's sort of at the heart of what's happening. Obviously what's happening in the book, but what's happening in this world, whereas the large story is the dystopia, the overthrow, et cetera, correct?
Yes, absolutely. I tend to always like the small story better than the big story. And the big story, it needs to be there, and it's still interesting, you know, and obviously you learn about the world, and I'm sure a lot of readers prefer that, the big world building, you know, and the political climate and the quarantine but I feel like stories that we can relate to are about a person. You can't really relate to a political climate or
right.
a world.
Right. Yeah,
so,
That's, I think, finding Sid is immensely relatable, especially for people who I actually want to find it to read it aloud, because you have a content warning at the beginning of your book that I really love. I'm a big fan of content warnings. And you also seem to like them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just a safeguard, you know, it's common courtesy.
Yes. Yours has one that's different than most that I've seen.
I wasn't sure how to how to mention things without spoiling, but while still being specific enough that, you know,
people would understand what it is they're getting into. You do not shy away either. You do not shy away from the brutal in your book, whether it is a circumstance or whether it is, and whether it is just the way that Sid narrates something. Even at the beginning of the book, lovemaking for Sid is a brutal experience. It is not one without consent, but he's an easygoing, unrestrained guy. He loves to drink. He loves to fuck. And even like the first time in the book that Sid has sex, it is this, it's really powerfully brutal the way that sex actually is. Like, sex is not an innately pleasant looking experience.
No. And I think, first of all, that in the first draft, that scene was a fade to black scene.
Really?
So, yeah.
I'm so glad that it's not, because it actually gives us so much more insight into who Sid is.
I was 23 and in school, and I was very afraid of writing stuff.
Sure.
I was a bit, I don't want to say provocative, because that feels like it's trying to make people go like, ooh. No, let's just say I didn't want to write something that people could question me about.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I don't know if that makes sense, but
how old are you now, Alistair, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 31.
Oh, okay. Okay. So I'm 38. So you and I both grew up in the same time of also massively seeing perspectives of what belongs in literature changing for the better, because the 90s was an era in which it was like propriety. It was almost like a revisitation of like the 40s and 50s on TV, where we wanted to embrace, we wanted to see queer characters, but we didn't want to see them in our books either. And that publishing didn't really want to embrace them too well. Yeah. And so I think that the fade to black, the not wanting to be questioned, is such an interesting response to like the feelings that leaves in us as creators.
Yeah. I think also back then I wasn't out. Mm-hmm. I was completely unaware. So I was very uncomfortable, I think, in general. Not just with myself, and just in general, I was uncomfortable. I'm still kind of working on it, but I was very, very afraid of what people would think of me. And I had just started writing in English as well. I wasn't sure that I wasn't going to be told, this isn't how this is told, this is said.
Right. You know? Right. Did you have any complications with that as you wrote? Like when you say you hadn't written in English before, you speak French as your first language, right?
Yes. Although now I'm married to an American guy, a Hawaiian guy, so I speak English in my day-to-day life.
Okay.
But yeah, I did grow up in France, and I didn't start really learning English until I was 13, 14.
More power to you for learning, because not only do you know English, but now I imagine you live in Quebec. So I imagine you speak Quebec French is way different than across the pond French.
It is different. And it's called, like, I can obviously understand and speak both. I mean, I say speak both, but I mean, it's the same language. It's different. In the same way that maybe American English and some British English might be,
right.
You know, and so there are differences and like slang terms or expressions that when I was at school, because my mom would speak with Quebec expressions, my dad would speak mostly with French expressions, and I had no idea which were which. So I would go to school in France and say something, and everyone was like, what?
Shout out, by the way, to your mom and your dad. I am warmed to the heart every time that you have such a you shared a picture of your dad with me with my book, and I absolutely I fell in love. Your dad just looks like such a fun loving guy. Your mom is so sweet. Like your mom we've interacted on Twitter, and your mom has interacted on stuff, and it wasn't until later that you would send me, you're like, Rance, that's my mom. And I was like, what the hell? She's so great. So hi, Alistair's mom. I lucked out.
Yeah, I definitely lucked out on the parents' front.
They're so cool. And it really shows your capacity to write about love feels in some way inspired by that love that I imagine that you've been shown. Would you say that like the way that your parents have demonstrated love in your life is something that's influenced how you write?
It probably has. I never really thought of it, but yeah, like everything, it probably has. And
yes, Rance, I've been influenced by all these things that occurred in my life.
I mean, yeah, I haven't. I wish I'd thought of it more. Maybe I should be a little more grateful. You know, yeah, absolutely, for sure. There's stuff that I can write about that maybe probably a lot of my friends who are not that lucky mm-hmm. would maybe struggle a bit more to talk about, or maybe they wouldn't want to because they would need to talk about what they went through.
Right. Right.
Which is fair. You know,
your parents absolutely kick ass.
I think just the fact that I can write.
Yeah.
At all, that is because like if they told me that I couldn't, I wouldn't have done it, and just I was encouraged to do it. So obviously, it's much easier than someone whose family isn't that supportive of their writing. You know, and maybe they think, yeah, I have a friend who's like that, and they didn't get that encouragement, and so they're more prone to giving up or feeling down on themselves. I just lucked out. I'm just super privileged that I was encouraged and pushed to pursue it.
It's funny that you reflect on that, because I think about that a lot too, Alistair, just about like what it is how encouragement feeds into our creative endeavors. I'm a writer because I love writing, but I was encouraged as a teenager to continue and to pursue my writing. Who that didn't happen to is my brother. My brother, Bob, the other half of the Quarantine Book Club, he loved writing. I think still loves writing. However, my father, who had his own struggles with PTSD and a lot of other things that in the late 80s, early 90s were not approached with the same kind of logic and understanding that we have now, he didn't get treatment the way that he needed to. And there was a circumstance in which my brother was writing. He had literally binders full of stuff. And my dad threw it away and was like, why are you wasting your time on this shit? And that fucked with him. And he hasn't really, he creates, but doesn't really write the way that I do. He's found other creative endeavors. And I sometimes think it's resolved. Like as I was growing up, my dad was treated. He was medicated. He was seeing people for these issues that he was dealing with. And so he was a much more approachable and a much more, I hate to say reasonable, but he was a much more reasonable person as I was growing up. So writing wasn't seen as like a distraction.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the time, the difference between someone who actually goes to the end of writing the book and getting things done and someone who doesn't isn't like, well, you're good and I'm not. No, the difference is when I was showing my writing to my parents, I was told, that's great, sweetie, keep going.
Right. Keep going.
And when you did the same thing, what you got was like, what?
Yeah.
Or no, stop that, or whatever.
Yeah.
Even just whatever is is bad.
And yet even that is different than like, oh, hell no, you shouldn't be doing this, right? Like if that's the case, it all of a sudden becomes this, oh, this is a bad thing. I'm doing this. I shouldn't be exploring this part of myself. I shouldn't be writing like this. What a waste of time. And I feel really poorly for people who have had that hovering over their head as a creator.
Definitely. I looked at it. A lot of luck is
I want to talk about your content warning really quick, which I love. I'm learning about content warnings. I would say, and I'm going to put my hand in the air and say, the rants of 4 years ago would have gone, why the fuck do I need a content warning? Not because I thought it was my job or my expectation that I be made uncomfortable, but rather I didn't understand the need for them. And I have re-educated myself a lot more since then. And now I love them. I think content warnings are absolutely phenomenal. What a great tool to find the right readers and the people who need, you know, I had a teacher who told me, be charitable to a reader. Yeah. And to me, a content warning is one of the most charitable things you can do. Yours is different though, because it's a note. And I'd like, is it okay if I read it out loud?
Yeah, go for it. No problem.
So at the beginning of The Old Love and the New, it says, dear reader, thank you for your interest in Sid's story. Before you carry on, please be aware of the following. The Old Love and the New is set in an oppressive police state. It depicts and describes abuse, self-harm, suicide, and mental illness, including a schizoaffective disorder, depression, and anxiety. It contains strong and derogatory language, alcohol and drug use, graphic sex between two men, and graphic violence. I took my foot entirely off the brakes because sometimes the brakes aren't even there to be stepped on anymore. However, this means we'll be diving full speed into the good things as well as the bad. The Old Love and the New also depicts love and friendship, identity and passion, trust, hope, and unconditional support in the face of adversity. So here's to figuring ourselves out. Here's to sharing the bad and the good. Here's to pulling each other back up. Here's to laughter. Here's to love. And here's to you. Don't forget your seatbelt. Your content warning sort of comes across as a bit of a dedication too. Did you intend that?
I would say that, yeah, I sort of did. I intended it as an author's note more than I tried to blend in what would be a note about this is what I'm presenting to you. I don't know if it's for you, but you know, if you read this note, maybe you'll know if it's for you. And then you decide if you're coming with me on this or not, you know? And I think that's the point of the content warning, is like, here's what's going to happen. Not in detail, you know, it's not going to like spoil the story for you, but this is what you're in for. And do you want to read it?
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with people who read a book and they go, oh, you know, they look at a content warning and they go, you know what, this might not be for me, or this might not be for me right now.
Exactly. And those are not the people you want reading your book anyway.
They're the ones who are going to potentially leave you reviews or like, holy shit, this is, do not read this.
Exactly. This, if someone sees your content warning and then decides not to read your book, they shouldn't be reading your book, and they're not your intended audience.
Right, right.
So it's not going to hurt your sales. I mean, it's not going to hurt your reviews for sure. It's you don't want someone to pick up your book expecting something completely different than what it is. So that's the answer to, is it going to like spoil stuff? But yeah, also it's what I've heard a lot about content warnings, and from people who don't know what it's for and who don't usually, they don't have issues with any content. People who don't have a problem with content warnings, they never have triggers themselves.
Right.
It's not about, you know, spoiling something, and it's not about excusing or warning that it's going to be rude or that you might be offended. It's not about offense. And it's not about you might be offended by this. It's about if you've been through this and you cannot see it or read about it.
Yes. Yes.
It's going to happen. be warned. It's not, because if they read that and they weren't expecting it, what's going to happen is not that they're going to be offended, is that they're going to panic, break down, spiral down.
Yep.
They will come to harm, and it's actually harm. You know?
Absolutely. That right there is that to me is the key phrase, is that as a writer, if you do harm to your reader, you have not just failed. You have gone the other direction. You have done harm to somebody.
Like, yeah, exactly. You don't want that.
No. And we possess no right to do that, right? Like, that's one of the things, actually. Are you a horror reader? Do you read horror?
I have not read, like, I don't watch horror because of triggers.
Sure.
I just can't. I can't watch horror. But the horror that I've read, it's always been like classic Victorian horror.
Yeah.
Jekyll and Hyde, Dracula. I haven't read more modern horror. I've been wanting to.
I think that's one of the things that makes me either pick up or put down a horror book, because I'm the same way as you are, Alistair. I do not watch horror. And oftentimes it's because I'm just sort of, I'm going to get axes thrown at me. I'm just not interested in it.
That's
I don't know why.
There's just reason not to watch it.
Just not interested. I don't know why. Because oftentimes the horror that I like is like horror that is, for example, if I look at your book, if I look at The Old Love and the New, there are elements of horror in it. There are things that horrify me in this book.
There are horrific things. And if that were the only criterion for, is it a horror?
and I oftentimes find that horror writers, now there's been so many horror writers that are really embracing the power of the content warning as a tool to ensure that their readers can trust them, which I really like. I like knowing that my safety as a reader is in the hands of the writer. Because I want to enjoy this cathartic experience of being frightened without being traumatized. Would you say that there was any point in writing The Old Love and the New that you felt that you felt you were establishing trust for you as a writer in the reader?
I think that's a good question. I don't know exactly that I set out, or that, you know, that there were specific points where this happened, but I did try to for instance, the whole transcript story.
Yes.
I think it's probably where there is the most this could cause a trigger. This could cause, because a lot of it was inspired by testimonies and like and stuff that happened. I don't want to say I was lucky too, but when I was at school in France, a couple times we had survivors of the concentration camps come in and talk to us.
God, that had to have been heavy.
It was heavy for sure. But also it wasn't always, and the way that they would talk to us, a lot of the times was very matter of fact. And then this happened, and then that happened. And I didn't want to, obviously, like, it's not the same, and this is fiction and that's real life, you know. Obviously, I don't want to compare anything, but I tried to make it as authentic rather than realistic, but as authentic as possible. And I feel like that's where you establish trust, because people will trust that there's an internal, that they'll trust that the character makes sense, and that nothing will happen that is not processed by the character.
Yes.
it's a story about something that happened before. So there is that distance that you don't want to miss the emotional part of it, but there is a bit of an extra distance, which it's a bit of a buffer.
You're reading about a character process, almost processing as opposed to experiencing.
Yes, exactly. So the events happened, but yeah, that's something that I didn't. I tried to make it like that. That's part of why I decided to like have Olivia tell the story rather than flashing back to it.
Right.
I feel like if it's something like that, first of all, I would be completely unequipped to be in the moment with the character in that moment, because there is nothing that can compare to that.
Right.
So I would be much too afraid of not doing it right.
I love Alistair. You're over here blowing my mind. And this must be the result of having a master's in writing. Because I'm also thinking about this connection between the authentic and the realistic, that striving for authenticity is the key, not striving for realism. And so often I think I struggle telling people, like we were having the conversation earlier about, well, to hell with it. If it's realistic, what I want on the other end of that is I want it to be authentic, right? The authentic to a human experience, whether that is a human experience of violence, a human experience of love, a human experience of loss. How do you capture authenticity in the old love and the new?
I think first, a lot of it comes from my own thought process and my own the way that my brain works. While I don't have a schizoaffective disorder myself, is very similar to the way Sid's brain works. Mm-hmm. So,
we got to talk about his brain in a few minutes, because I fucking love Sid, and I love Sid for some very specific reasons. However, continue. I'm sorry to interrupt. My brain just couldn't stop going.
It's no problem. I'll interrupt myself a lot of the time anyway. A lot of it, I think, in terms of making it authentic, it's every character, you don't necessarily relate to them, but you can relate to stuff that's happening to them. And we can all relate to most of those things, you know. Even if the exact events haven't happened to you, there's stuff you can, there, it can remind you of something. Plus, you know, you've got empathy and you've seen people to whom it's happened and you've experienced the world. I think the only way to be authentic is to observe and listen to people and see what matters to them. And then that can be shaped by their personal experiences, by their cultural background, by a lot of things, but there's a few things are kind of universal. And if you build on that and then you add some cultural lens or identity lens, it's going to come together, because you're writing a person. So if you're watching people a lot, and I think a lot of writers do that. We watch people and listen to people, and that just kind of seeps into it.
Your dialogue is, I think, some of the best dialogue I've ever read. Oh. That is no exaggeration. I'm a sucker for dialogue, but my hair stands on end, if you can see it, thinking about the dialogue in your book. I've literally got goosebumps. Because it is so quick moving. It is so clever. It is the true heart of your book. It is the way that Sid not just interacts, but interfaces with everyone around him through this super realistic, hilarious, no holds barred dialogue. I think the F word shows up. it must be 30 times in the first two chapters. And I love that. Like, I'm not a person who's like, limit the amount of times you say fuck, because it's I say fuck. I must say it 100 times a day. And it's true. It feels so true to these characters, the way that they interact. However, I picked this book up, and what I didn't expect was that instead of it being, I knew that you were Canadian, I knew that you were, I knew that you spoke French. What I didn't expect was all of a sudden that I was going to be getting, like Manchester English in this book. And it sounds like, I could be getting this wrong. My father's father was from Liverpool. And so he was all about like calling people like Scousers. Like it feels like Scouser English in a way. Is that even an appropriate thing to say? I don't know.
Yeah. It's the accents and the slang might vary a little bit, but there's definitely a regional, a northern, England feel to it. It's set in London. It's not set in Manchester, but the character is from Manchester. And I studied writing in Glasgow, in Scotland. And then I moved to Manchester and I studied screenwriting there.
Okay.
For a little bit. Originally, Sid was from Leeds, which is in Yorkshire. And I moved him to Manchester after living in Manchester for a bit, because I didn't feel I could convey a Leeds speech pattern and accent as well as I could a Manchester one, for having lived with a Mancunian guy and lived in Manchester for a while.
You know? It is like the Yorkshire, and I say this foolishly because I've only spent 4 collective weeks of my life in England, and I stayed in Yorkshire, and right. I loved it. I absolutely loved Northern England. However, you're 100% right. The way that they speak is so vastly different than the way it's spoken, even in like Manchester or in the South, and almost like another language.
That's something that I love about language, is regional variance and dialect and linguistics and stuff like that. So I was just having fun.
Oh, it's a blast to read. It really is. It feels so natural. And I literally questioned Alistair. I was like, is Alistair from England? And I didn't know this. And I was instantly knowing, you know, getting the opportunity to know you before I read the book, I was all of a sudden questioning everything I knew about you, because it was so, so effectively done. And I loved having that experience as a reader, because I was like, holy crap, this really shows me just how killer a writer he is. And you are those moments in the book where Sid's schizoaffective disorder is really, really punching home and really hitting hard are phenomenal. Sid's voice as our protagonist and our narration character is so on point. I feel like I could read anything else and I would know that it's Sid. If you would put like a short story out and I didn't know who had written it, I would know if it was Sid. And it's so, so distinctive a voice. Were there any things that you're really proud of to develop a distinctive voice like that? Things that when you were writing it, you were like, oh, I got this. This is so good.
I think because I started writing Sid in 2012, 2013. His voice evolved, obviously. He wasn't like that from the start. But now I feel like I could probably write anything through the lens of This Is Sid narrating.
Yeah.
And it would not be too off the mark. I wouldn't be too out of character. What I would say what was very difficult, and I ended up very proud of it, is roughly around the midpoint, and the psychotic, the episode of psychosis. It's something that I was in a lot of the first draft, like most of the first drafts, second draft, third draft, it was not at all the way it ended up. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't caught on to the fact that the symptoms that I'd given Sid were schizophrenia and schizoaffective, right? And eventually it just clicked, wait a minute, this isn't the guy with an anxiety disorder and a depression, or it is, but not just that, you know, there's voices and there's stuff like that. So right. I leaned into it. And once I'd discovered, okay, once I'd given him the right diagnosis, really, because I didn't set out to write about schizophrenia. But once I realized this is what he's got, it's got to be, because these are the symptoms he's got. So instead of trying to represent schizophrenia, I gave him the way he is. And then I stepped back and like, okay, what is this that I'm writing? Right. And then, yeah, it's a psychosis, because there's voices, there's paranoia, an element of delusional thinking. And then after that was when I started really looking into it and doing the research that I probably should have been doing from the start, you know, and I wasn't. I'm really glad the book didn't get picked up or anything back then. It was completely off.
Yeah. It's funny how writing over the course of a long period of time, it actually is something that frightens me now as a writer. Writing over the course of a long period of time, your first book, you can take forever to write it. But then after that, it feels sometimes like there's a ticking clock, like, oh, when's your next one? When's your next one? And I know in my own personal experiences, it took me 10 years to create what I have now. And it was a very different book in the first of those 10 years. And I would have hated if that was the book that I put out there. And I love how much it was able to like percolate and change and truly become what I wanted to. And now I'm a little afraid that like, what if I don't give the next one 10 years? Like, am I going to hate that one?
You know, I only got this first one out, so I have no answer. I don't know. And yeah, it could be, what if the next one is rushed or anything?
But you also know it. You also know this world and how to write about these experiences with far more accuracy now. Whether or not
from scratch.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You've done the research now, or some. Obviously, we continue needing to research, and whether or not you know, what you write next is in line with this or it's something completely different, you have at least done a certain kind of research to prepare yourself for writing what you wanted to write.
Yeah, exactly. You never start book two from scratch, even if it's not a series. I feel like, you know, you've got some experience.
Yes.
It's still going to be a challenge, and there's different challenges for sure. I'm seeing a lot of my writer friends working on their subsequent books, and yeah, they have different challenges and different expectations.
You have such a cool relationship with music in this book, too. It is hilarious at times, and also I think in its hilarity, also really harrowing.
Yeah,
you ended up needing to get the rights to a song for this book. Can you tell me about that? Because I am so intrigued. You got the rights to a huge song, but you also got the rights to a freaking song. So like, how did that go? Obviously, I know what the song is, but if people haven't read the book, I would ask you to say what the song is. And like, how did you get the rights to it? And how did it work into your favor to write so intimately about music, or have music be such an intimate part of the way this book moves?
First of all, the song, Sid uses a song and lyrics and singing to ground himself during panic attacks and panic moments. And he falls back on it. And the song is It's Raining Men.
Which I shouldn't laugh at, but it's also so great.
It was on purpose that it's kind of a goofy, silly song, and that's that my brother picked it because I was like, and until quite close to the end, I think it was third draft that I decided it's going to be a song, because before that, all he had as a coping mechanism was breathing exercises. And I decided that that was a bit generic, first of all, and a song would be more interesting. Plus, it's something, I don't know why I didn't think of it before, because I use music, like I use singing and humming and, you know, to calm myself as well. It's something that's useful,
sure.
Because it regulates your breathing. It does, to me, better than a breathing exercise, like 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, because
yeah. A breathing exercise is so intentful, and it's like, it's so exactly. Unnatural in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas singing, if you're singing, you don't even realize what you're doing is regulating your breathing.
Yeah.
Because you're just focusing on the song. So yeah, what I did was like, okay, it's going to be a song, but like, I can't make it this heavy handed, like sad or, and I need it to be goofy and ridiculous.
It also grounds the reader and the book in this alternate reality, a world in which It's Rain and Men is the song that Sid uses to ground himself is our reality.
There is that too. Yes. I definitely like having pop culture references and anything that can make it more now and more like here. And so, yeah, I ended up, I texted my brother, like, quick, I need a goofy song for him to sing. He texted back almost immediately.
It's Raining Men. It's Raining Men.
Cool. Perfect. Perfect. And so, yeah, I ended up having to get the rights for that. At first, I didn't, I mean, I kind of knew, like, I knew sort of that I would need, you can't do that.
Especially if it's such a big part of the book.
Exactly. And I could have, when I ran it by my editor, that was one thing that she pointed out, one of the first things that she pointed out. And I'd already thought about it, and I was already in the process at that point. But yeah, she did like point out, you can't quote song lyrics that much, that it doesn't fall under fair use anymore. It's too much, right? So either you need the rights to it or you need to edit it out. But I think editing it out would take a big part of the book away.
And so did you have to get in contact with like the rights holders and pay for it?
Yes, twice.
If you don't mind me asking, you don't have to give specific numbers, but is it a number that is large enough that like if you could have avoided using the song that you would have knowing how much it cost?
It cost me around, like, it was over $200.
Really?
Yeah.
I suppose that's not,
it's not that
as bad as I thought.
It's not that bad. It's not that bad.
Were there any weird limitations on it? I'm so curious now.
Yes. I mean, I'm fine because, like, I have, I can print out, I believe it's 5,000 copies.
Oh, okay. Before needing to re-up the rights.
Before needing to pay again. Also, it's actually two different rights holder. I didn't know that going in, that the rights to It's Raining Men are split 50-50.
Wow.
Between two different companies. So I contacted the first one because that's the first ones I found was like, okay, they have it on their catalog. I'll just go through the regular process. They have like forms and stuff. You pitch the book and then you tell them like, okay, this is for instance, a scene where this is how it works. How much would this be? And is that okay? And they come back. It took a little while, but not that long. Maybe a month or two before it was done. And yeah, you pay for a certain amount of copies.
That is there any suggestions you'd give to anybody who might be listening who wants to seek out using rights for something like that, like song lyrics? Any suggestions you can offer now that you've gone through that, what I imagine is a bit of a hellacious process?
Yeah, it's not that complicated, but it takes a little time. So I would definitely don't wait until the last minute to do it. I had to put my the formatter on hold for a bit because you need to include the legal text at the start of the book, right?
Right.
Use with permission, blah blah blah. They tell you, they send you exactly what they want you to put in the book. So yeah, just know that it can take a little while for them to get back to you, and there's also who to contact. Took me a while to figure it out.
Yeah, I think that's the part I'm so intrigued about. Is like, did you have to go on Google and just type in rights holder? Yeah. It's Raining Men.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I did. That is what I did. I basically Googled copyright, It's Raining Men, you know, funny. Print license. What you want is a print license to print the lyrics. You don't need the rights to the melody. You need the rights to the lyrics.
Right? Interesting.
That's another thing that, you know, I've been thinking about doing audiobook. Can't really do an audiobook because
without that,
you need a different license.
Well, I would say there's always a possibility too that perhaps one thing that I heard recently I loved, having gone through the audiobook process myself, and I had to tell this, the audiobook narrator I had was phenomenal. However, there were still times where I was like, that's not how I hear it in my head. And I had to really catch myself because I'm A, not a director. B, it's this dude's job and profession to do this, right? He knows what he's doing way more than I ever can. And also, I read somewhere, it's like, your audiobook is an adaptation. It is not your book. Yeah. And I was like, ooh, okay, I like that. So I have to be cool. I have to be cool with not having full creative control. That's on the narrator. Could you see perhaps, could you use the lyrics to It's Raining Men without it ever being sung?
I could probably, but I don't know if I would want to.
Sure. Gotcha.
I feel like if I go for an audiobook, I will want to actually do the process so that can be sung, because it's become a huge part of the character.
Yeah.
I feel like it would stand out as, oh, you don't have the rights to this, do you? You know? And I wouldn't want to feel like it's restrained because of that. And I wouldn't want to feel eye-catching or ear-catching, you know, like, I can tell that this is something that they had to do, right?
Yeah.
So I'm holding off until, because I don't doubt that it's possible. It's just probably quite a lot of money. Mm-hmm. That, and for audiobook purposes, I think I would want to make it a bit more experimental than what Audible, what is it, ACX or?
Yeah.
Than what their box, their process is like. So I don't know exactly how that would go, but I would want to look into that more before I went into it.
Yeah. Like in the act of using the song or something like that, like making it more of a different like audio experience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. It's definitely an adaptation. That's good. And there, you know, also the transcript parts, I'm pretty sure I would want to do something different with that. I'm pretty sure I would have three actors. So it's kind of it's a bit different, and maybe sound design there. We need something. I don't know.
Anyway. I think that's one of the things that I love about The Old Love and the New so much, though, is that it is such a unique book. We say that a lot about indie publication, but I truly believe that your book may be one of the most unique ones that I have had the pleasure of reading. It is experimental in nature. You deal so wonderfully with both respectfully, but in accuracy with the way mental health is written on the page. There's a moment in the book specifically where Sid talks about his tardive dyskinesia that I loved that little bit of information in there as well, because knowing what that is, it was clear to me. It was like, oh, this isn't just something thrown in there. This is something that Sid experiences and also that Alistair knew well enough how to write about. And I appreciated the respect that you took in writing about Sid's struggles, because I think so oftentimes, and we even, since you had mentioned you love like old horror, we look at something like old horror, and one of the problems that old horror had was that, that mental condition that we can't explain. Oh, it's just a tool. It's just a device for storytelling now. Insanity is a device.
Yes. And there's a lot of bad representation, and I did not want to feed into that. I was very wary of misrepresenting any something that's so stigmatized already and misunderstood and misrepresented a lot in the media. Horror especially, but also thrillers, I find a lot of the time they're interested in mental health conditions like schizophrenia or dissociative identity disorder, which is like what people will call multiple personality disorder and stuff like that, you know. But it's dissociative identity disorder, and it's a real thing, you know. It's not a plot device.
Yes, yes.
It's not you know, one of them is good and the other one is the killer, you know.
Right.
It's not Jekyll and Hyde.
It's back not then,
it was back... interesting. Now, maybe you don't.
right. I think about that a lot with Poe. Like if I'm teaching about Edgar Allan Poe, identifying that this is, you know, this is insanity as a novelty. There's a different way that we write and we talk about insanity as a plot device, we need to identify this is not accurate representation in any capacity of the way that, like, just because you experience some dissociative, you know, something dissociative doesn't mean that you're it doesn't mean that you're about to put a body under the floorboards, like, mm-hmm. And whereas with Poe or anybody else, it was like, oh yeah, this is what leads them putting it under the floorboards. And I love that Sid's experience is so grounded in the desire to, from you, the writer, for it to be as accurate as possible without it being misrepresented at all. And I felt like there was no point in there where you misrepresented.
I hope not. I tried to, I mean, I didn't try to, I did it. I just listened to people who actually have the condition, instead of listening to specialists of the condition, right? Because a specialist, they will have the perspective of a specialist, and they will know what you can learn from them is technical stuff. Like, this is the medication that's used for this. This is, or we can use this or that. This happens because this happens in the brain, or this happens during that or not. But they will not have the emotional connection to it that, or the everyday to it, because they will only see someone who's struggling a lot, right? They won't have the everyday life of someone who's living with it on a daily basis and who actually is going about their life and has a job, you know, and just, you might know them and not even know they have it.
Right.
It's not necessarily someone who's in an institution forever, or who you couldn't relate to because they're just so wrapped up in their own reality, because that's what psychosis is. It's not split personality. Schizophrenia is not split personality. It's a split mind.
Yeah,
which is when your reality is not the reality that other people are experiencing, right? So instead of listening to people who write about it in a book, I feel it's more respectful as well as authentic to just listen to people who have it.
Yes.
And ask them, like, what do you not see, or what do you see and you don't like, or what do you wish you could see instead of what, you know? And yeah, there's a lot of YouTube content where people with a condition will react to media about the condition.
That's really interesting too. Like that point that you're referencing something like someone has, you know, we talk a lot of the time about like it being exhausting for people who experience these things to need to be the authorities on them. And I think that's very interesting because YouTube gives us these tools to be so educated. And this is someone who in that moment has been like, okay,
want to do this.
I have the capacity in this moment to react in this way to show people like, okay, this is what's real. This is what isn't.
Exactly. Just like it doesn't, that way it doesn't put the burden on someone like right now. Oh, right. Hey, can you tell me about this very personal thing? Like,
educate me about this thing right now.
Exactly. Don't you want people to know about this?
Right. It's like, oh no.
As someone who's been asked like those questions, it's about other stuff. About queerness and trans identity, it's nice to just go to where people have already given the information,
right? And then it's on record, and that it is a reliable source in that capacity through experience and knowledge.
It is what they wanted to put out there.
Yes.
So they're not caught off guard, and they're not sharing stuff they didn't decide to share. So there is that. There is a lot of reactions to movies, Beautiful Mind, which had a fairly positive reaction. I think a lot of people, if it's not, they're happy when it's not, the character is not a killer, is already, you know, you would think this would be very basic, but they're just so happy that it's
Yes. Oh, wow. This wasn't used as a crutch to explain someone's actions. Okay.
Exactly. But that doesn't mean it's good. You know,
right.
That still doesn't mean that it's accurate or that it's authentic.
Right.
Sometimes it's used as a prism to show how accepting this other person is, you know, the main character, you know, and you see that a lot with autistic characters as well, you know, in Rain Man, for instance. And the main character is the brother, who's neurotypical, and isn't he having this great journey where he's learning to be a good guy because he's got this burden that's put on him because the other person is.
Oh, and he'll grow past his initial frustration. And wow, exactly. don't we all identify with his frustration?
Exactly. And it's like, do you want a cookie?
Yeah.
Just. And a lot of that is, from what I've heard, very annoying. That because once again, it's a plot device.
Yes,
and you're being used as a plot device.
I actually was thinking about that just the other day. I saw there is, you know, and it's actually terrifying how, or maybe somewhat satisfying to identify how much our perception of these things have changed in just the past 12 years. But I was clicking through the television and that Sandra Bullock movie, The Blind Side, was on, and about the football linebacker who, and he was actually a football linebacker here for our local team. And basically the movie is, here is a black kid from poverty who is it's not so much his story as it is, oh, look how his plight highlights how good Sandra Bullock's character is. And I'm like, ooh, this movie feels bad in 2021. That's, like, it does not feel good to watch in that regard at all.
It's probably something that has to happen on the way to the best possible way to include and represent something. It's a step forward, but when you look back, it's still not good.
No.
But it's, at back then, it was better than what we had.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But, yeah, it's still not great. Let's be honest.
my wife and I were sitting there watching. We're like, oh, this,
yeah, and it's kind of icky now.
It really is. I would not want that movie to like show up on my it feels so inauthentic, going back to that word. And especially because it is, as you had said, and I love the example of Rain Man. I've never thought about this before. These characters not being the focal point, but rather being seen as just a prism through which to see the changes of this other protagonist. Alistair, is there anything about The Old Love and the New that you want people to know about if they haven't picked it up yet, or to encourage them to pick it up?
It's a human story. I think it's about a person, and it's about a character, and it's a character story as much as it's set in a dystopian, against a dystopian backdrop. It's about a little found family. And that's, I think, hopefully it's the heart of it, and hopefully it does bring it heart. You know, hopefully it's not gonna make you terribly depressed. It is dark, but I do think ultimately it's about love. So it should be in ways uplifting.
I found it immensely so. There were moments in the book that I was battered down. I was like, oh my God, this is heavy. However, none of those felt like A, they were manipulative of me or my feelings, and B, they felt like they were necessary experiences in the context of the novel, and ones that would later in some capacity lead to a future of hope for this found family as well.
Yeah. That's what I'm hoping for, that it's not just doom and gloom.
Yeah.
And also that it doesn't show that everyone is, that humans are bad when left to their own devices. A lot of dystopian, you see something bad happens, everything falls to shit, everyone betrays everyone, nobody really cares about anyone anymore.
Yes, it becomes Lord of the Flies in that regard.
Exactly. Yeah exactly. And we return to our wild animal state, and we'll just rip each other apart. Hopefully, the book conveys the opposite.
I think it absolutely does. If there was any concern in your mind that it conveyed that, I'm here to tell you, as an immensely satisfied reader, it absolutely does. Love is at the very heart of this book.
Yeah, that's what I was going for. So good. Excellent.
I enjoyed the living hell out of it, and it made me so happy to see your book received with such praise. Obviously people have been loving it. As you know, I said that a friend of the show, Keith, who had specifically reached out to me by text and said that the book was a spectacular experience. And I can only imagine that you're going to continue having that kind of positive reaction for it too. There's people who are going to see themselves in the book, and they're going to see themselves in Sid. I saw myself, parts of myself, especially in Sid. And that's one of the things I love about a first person narrator, is that I get a chance to be in their head and inside their shoes. And so oftentimes that first person narrator is a tool by which I reflect on my own experiences. So thank you for that.
That's my pleasure. That's what I would want for this book to do. And that's also what I like as a reader. And that's also why I tend to prefer first person narratives. There's just an immediacy to it. And like, yeah.
I will do my best to meme your book as well in some capacity. You are so good at it, but I am not, but I'm going to learn just so I can meme your book.
Oh, I'm just, you know, procrastinating. That's what I do.
So Alistair, where can people find you and get in contact with you? Where can they get your book? What are some things that you can leave us with so that way they know if they're listening this far, which they damn well should, if they're listening this far, where they can pick everything up and get in touch with you at?
Yeah, the book is available through Amazon. The book is The Old Love and the New on Amazon, Kindle. It's also available wide. So if you go Barnes & Nobles, Kobo, all of the usual retailers, it'll be on there. I'm on Twitter at Alistair Karadec, and I also have a website where you can read the opening scene of the book, alistairkaradec.com. So you can, if you want to know what you're getting into, read the first scene over there and see if you like it.
You're going to like it.
I wouldn't want someone to purchase it who is not going to like it. So the point is, you know, read the start.
Figure out if it's for you, and damn well should be.
If it's not, no problem. But I like it. I think it's human and it's got heart. So
it does. And I think it is a creation of which you should be immensely proud. And I am deeply grateful for it as well, because I got, you know, seeing it from the moment that you announced, you're like, all right, I'm doing this thing in November, and following up through that, there was not a single bit of disappointment whatsoever. So thank you for sharing that story with us. And I'm looking forward to learning more about Sid in the future as well.
Yes, I am working on a sequel. So
so keep up to date.
I should be working on a sequel.
Or video games. Or but hey, you know what? You're allowed to, though, at this point. Play video games. You got time. Right. No one out there is telling you, you gotta have it out in the next year.
Yeah, exactly. It'll take whatever time it takes, you know, but I will be working on it. And I do have, like, there is a lot that I think can happen yet. There'll be a second book. I hadn't planned that there would be a second book. But there will be a second book.
When we love a narrator or an experience or a world so much, it's sometimes really hard to go, oh, this is a one and done. I'm good.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you don't want, like, once the story is done, you don't want to oversee your welcome. But at the same time, I feel like in this case, there's
stories to be told.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's stories to be told. Alistair, thanks for hanging out with me today.
Thank you.
If you guys didn't happen to hear it, you can find Alistair online, alistairkaradec.com. I'll have the link in this in their description as well. I like how I'm pointing down as though we're on a video and I'm not videoing this because videoing terrifies me. This is the audio. This is the sound of my finger going down. You can find you can find Alistair Karadec, alistairkaradec.com. Find him on Twitter as well. Alistair, thanks for coming to hang out with me today. I really appreciate it. Make sure to pick up a copy of The Old Love and the New, and of course, leave a review. Alistair, have an awesome rest of your day.
You too. Thanks.